So there are different methods of acquiring knowledge or attempting to acquire knowledge. Earlier today, someone asked, how do we know if Krishna consciousness is real? And I replied, among other things, how do we know if anything is real? So, according to Vedic philosophy, Veda literally means knowledge. According to Vedic philosophy, there are different methods for acquiring knowledge, or different types of evidence. The best method is called Shabda, which literally means sound, and in this context it means the sounds coming from a higher plane of existence. The sounds coming from the spiritual world, coming from the Supreme Being, coming from self-realized sages. Another type of evidence is called Anuman. Anuman means inference, logic, reason. We might hear some sound outside of this room, and we don't actually see where it's coming from. But we surmise that a car is passing by on the street. We haven't seen the car, but from the sound, we think it's a car. But it might not be. And then the third type is called pratyaksha, which means direct perception. And direct perception is also very limited. Our senses function within a certain range. For example, a sound vibration, if it's very high, we can't hear it. If it's very low, we can't hear it. An object of vision, if it's very small, we can't see it. If it's very far, we can't see it. Our senses are limited in so many ways. And therefore, direct perception is not considered reliable, and inference is also not considered reliable. But Shabda is considered most reliable. So, in our meetings, we often speak, and this is with the tradition that Srila Prabhupada, who's our teacher, founder, set the example he set, and that his predecessor set, is that they read from a sacred text, Shabda, and comment on it. And what they comment also is not based on their own mental speculation, but it's based on information shabda, information descending, transcendental sounds descending from higher regions. So, following that tradition, we will speak on a verse from Srimad Bhagavatam. Now, this is Bhagavad Gita. This is the basic book of Vedic knowledge, the essence, spoken by Lord Krishna himself. And far advanced than the Bhagavad Gita is Srimad Bhagavatam, which is a much longer work. This is the whole Bhagavad Gita, 700 verses. Srimad Bhagavatam is 18,000. And it is published in many volumes. But we're going to read a verse from Srimad Bhagavatam tonight, which brings together many points that I've been asked to speak about today. You can hear the sound vibration itself is purifying, and we'll speak in English. Please repeat after me. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We read from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 3, Pure Devotional Service, Text 23. Jivam chavo bhagavatam virenum najatu martyo vilabeta yastu Sri Vishnu padya manujastu lasya Chasan chavoyas tuna veda gandam. Jivan chavo bhagavatam grirenum. Najatu martyo vilabeta yastu. Sri Vishnu padya manujastu lasya. Svasan chavoyas tuna veda gandam. Translation. The person who has not at any time received the dust of the feet of the Lord's pure devotee upon his head is certainly a dead body. And the person who has never experienced the aroma of the tulsi leaves from the lotus feet of the Lord is also a dead body, although breathing. Report by Srila Prabhupada. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, the breathing dead body is a ghost. When a man dies, he is called dead. But when he again appears in a subtle form, not visible to our present vision, and yet acts, such a dead body is called a ghost. Ghosts are always very bad elements, always creating a fearful situation for others. So I'll stop here. The first instruction of the Bhagavad Gita is that the living entity is a spiritual particle distinct from the material energy. Matter is created, it endures for some time, and then it is destroyed, or at least the different manifestations of matter. Whereas the Atma is eternal. It has no beginning and no end. Nahanyate hanyamane sarire. When the body, it is not slayed when the body is slayed. So, our actual identity is spiritual. We all understand that there's a difference between a living body and a dead body. But what is the difference? The difference is that in the living body, the Atma is present. And in the dead body, the Atma has gone. All the other ingredients of the body are there. All the organs are there. Everything is there, pretty much, that was there the moment before the person died. But something has changed. And what has changed is that the actual person, the Atma, has left the body. And no matter what you do to the body after the Atma is gone, you cannot bring the body back to life. So everyone by nature is interested in his own benefit, his own self-interest. But we cannot really know what our self-interest is unless we know what our self is, what our actual self is. And our actual self is not the body, but the soul, the Atma, within the body. And because we misidentify ourselves with the body, we are never satisfied or happy. It's just the body is like a cage. And the Atma is like a bird within the cage. You can decorate the cage very nicely with silk cushions and valuable jewels and scent it with aromatic flowers and incense. But if you don't feed the bird will not be happy. Eventually the bird will die. So the body is like a cage, and we do so much for the sake of the body, but we always remain dissatisfied because we're not feeding our real self. We're just polishing the cage, the bars of the cage. So understanding who we are, what is our real self, is the key to understanding what is our self-interest. And our self-interest is to become reestablished in our eternal relationship with the Supreme Soul. In Sanskrit, there's the word Atma, Jivatma, which is the individual soul, and Paramatma, which is the Supreme Soul. And we can only be happy and satisfied in that relationship. Fully happy and fully satisfied. there was an authority, I should say there is an authority on marriage. He has written books and he travels extensively conducting seminars and workshops. And he said that marriage is not meant to make you happy. Marriage is meant to make you married. And when you're properly and securely married, that provides a structure within which you can find your own happiness. So, in Vedic terms, that is the principle of Varnashram Dharma. That we find a situation that provides some, you know, we're in the material world, but provides some security and some stability within which we can find our own happiness. And our own happiness means spiritual happiness. The temporary pleasures of the material world cannot really be called happiness because they're very flickering. So, that the food for the soul is devotional service, bhakti. Bhakti yoga. Yoga means to link or connect. Like we have the English word yoke, which comes from yoga, to yoke two oxen to a cart. So yoga means to connect with the Supreme, and bhakti means devotional service. So through bhakti yoga, we can connect to the Supreme and actually be happy and satisfied. Now, this verse mentions the living dead, or I should say, the breathing dead. And Srila Vishwanatha Chakrabarti Thakur, who's one of the great authorities on the line, says that a dead person who breathes is a ghost. Now, how many people in this room believe that ghosts exist? Raise your hand. How many of you think that ghosts are just something that people believe in based on some sort of superstition, or ghosts are just something that you read about in books? Okay. So, according to the analysis of the Atma, the soul being eternal and existing after it leaves the body. So then the next question is, and every one of us should ask this question, where does the soul go after it leaves the body? Because its duration in the body is very limited. 60 years, 80 years, 100 years. Not to exclude the possibility, but it is possible, or even likely, that 100 years from now, not a single one of us will be in the same body that we're in now. And so, okay, say we have 100 years in this body, probably not even that much, but say 100 years in this body. And after we leave the body, we have 100 million, billion, trillion, gazillion years. No limit. So it would really be sensible for us to consider where we're going after we leave the body. Just like if you're in a house that's condemned, you will think, where am I going to go next? You're not going to spend all your time decorating the house that's condemned and you're going to have to leave. It's more important to figure out where you're going to go. Or more precisely, where you want to go. And then take measures to get there. So, according to Vedic literature, there are 8,400,000 species of life, and you can enter into any one of them, depending on your karma, your activities, and your thoughts at the time of death. And there are higher planets, there are lower planets, there are intermediate planets. So you should decide where you want to go. And then you should decide how to get there. And so the Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, give explanations how to achieve different, give directions how to achieve different destinations. But the best destination, by any analysis, is to get released from the cycle of birth and death, from having to take birth again in the material world and suffer, but rather to go to the spiritual realm and live eternally with, in loving service to, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So now, what is a ghost? Coming back to that question, a ghost is not really exactly one of those 8,400,000 species of life. But a ghost is a living entity who didn't want a physical body. One way to become a ghost, pretty much maybe the most common way to become a ghost, is to commit suicide. Because committing suicide means, in effect, you don't want a physical body. But you're not liberated, because most people commit suicide because they have material desires and they feel frustrated or disappointed. They're so disappointed that their desires have been frustrated that they commit suicide. So they have material desires, but they didn't want a gross physical body, so they get a ghost's body. And they are very frustrated, more frustrated, because they have all the same material desires, but they have no chance of fulfilling them through that ghost body. There was a movie some years ago called Ghost. And I heard devotees say that it gave quite an accurate depiction of the life of a ghost. And they even surmised that the people who made the movie had read Srila Prabhupada's books, read Srimad Bhagavatam. So anyway, I didn't go to see it. But lo and behold, it so happened that on a flight I took, it was being shown on the airplane.
so I couldn't resist. And just to give an example, there's one scene where the ghost is on a railway platform, and there's a vending machine with cigarettes, and like he really wants to smoke a cigarette, but he can't because he doesn't have a gross physical body. So because they have material desires without a gross material body, they try to gain possession of someone else's body so they can fulfill their desires through the other person's body. And therefore, they create disturbances. So, anyway, this is, we could say more about ghosts. It is a big topic. Just very briefly, the other way a living entity can take birth as a ghost is if he or she is very attached to something inanimate. Like, say someone is living in a big castle or palace, and they're very much invested in that palace or castle or mansion. And at the time of death, they think of their mansion. So they can't take birth as a mansion because it's not a type of body that you can get. But they can take birth as a ghost in the mansion or palace or castle. And that's why a lot of big mansions are haunted by ghosts, because the owners are so attached. And when it is known that they're attached, that the mansion is haunted, people don't want to buy it. And it actually happened in the history of ISKCON that very big properties were available for a low cost because they were haunted. And the devotees asked Srila Prabhupada, what should we do? Should we buy it? And he said, yes, you can buy it and you chant Hare Krishna and the ghosts will go away. And you get a big property for a small price. But again, our subject here is not really ghosts. Our subject is what it means to be alive. So now I'll read how the example of a dead person breathing relates to us, every one of us here. So ghosts are always very bad elements, always creating a fearful situation for others. Similarly, the ghost-like non-devotees who have no respect for the pure devotees, nor for the Vishnu deity in the temples, create fearful situation, always create a fearful situation for the devotees at all times. The Lord never accepts any offerings by such impure ghosts. So, when someone, there's a beautiful verse in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which is the science of Bhakti Yoga, that says that the desire for material enjoyment and the desire for impersonal liberation, to like merge and become one with the light, are like ghosts and witches. And as long as one is haunted by these ghosts, one cannot relish the sweet taste of devotional service, bhakti yoga. So Why do we say that someone who has desires for material sense gratification or impersonal liberation is like a person haunted by a ghost? Because when a ghost gets possession of you, you think things that are not really you. Sometimes it happens momentarily. Someone is like possessed by a ghost and has all sorts of different thoughts that are very foreign to his usual consciousness. So as spiritual beings, our nature is to love and serve God, Krishna. That's our natural position. So to have these alien desires to want to gratify the senses of this body, or to escape the body and merge into some oneness or void, it's like being haunted by a ghost. So these aren't me, these aren't my desires, these are foreign to me. So to progress in bhakti and really relish that sweet taste, one has to be free from these ghost-like desires. And people who are possessed by these desires, they're also like ghosts. And they create difficulties for devotees, pure devotees. And how can they become free from their ghost-like existence? Is by taking shelter of pure devotees. That's the only way they can become free. And that is explained here in the verse and further in the purport. There is a common saying that one should first love the dog of the beloved before one shows any loving sentiments for the beloved. There's a saying, love me, love my dog. If you don't love my dog, you can't love me. The stage of pure devotion is attained by sincerely serving a pure devotee of the Lord. In other words, the pure devotees are like the pet dogs of the Lord. The first condition of devotional service to the Lord is therefore to be a servant of a pure devotee. And this condition is fulfilled by the statement, quote, reception of the dust of the lotus feet of a pure devotee who has also served another pure devotee, end quote. This is the way of pure disciplic succession or devotional parampara. In other words, for me to be released from my ghost-like existence, haunted by these extraneous desires to enjoy the senses or merge, I have to take shelter of a pure devotee. But who's a pure devotee? A pure devotee is someone who has taken shelter of another pure devotee, who in turn has taken shelter of another pure devotee. Going all the way back in our context to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who is Krishna, is God himself, in the role of a devotee. Maharaj Raghuvana inquired from the great saint Judd Bharat as to how he had attained such a liberated stage of a Paramahansa. And in answer, the great saint replied as follows, Bhagavatam 5.12.12. Rahuvanaita tapasanayati na che jaya nirvapanad grahadva.
Na chandasanai vajalavni suryair vina mahatpadarajo vishekam.
O King Rahugana, the perfectional stage of devotional service, or the Paramahamsa stage of life, cannot be attained unless one is blessed by the dust of the feet of great devotees. And that's in italics by Srila Prabhupada. It is never attained by tapasya, austerity, the Vedic worshipping process, acceptance of the renounced order of life, the discharge of the duties of household life, the chanting of the Vedic hymns, or the performance of penances in the hot sun, within cold water, or before blazing fire. So there are so many processes. Everywhere, people are recommending processes for spiritual elevation or self-realization. And none of them are effective to the point that one can actually achieve spiritual perfection. Only taking shelter of a pure devotee can bring one to the highest stage of perfection. And that is a little difficult. I mean, it's really not difficult, but it's a little difficult because of our false egos. Our false ego says, why should you bow down to someone else? Everyone should bow down to you. They just don't know your greatness. There is a singer named Boy George who visited the holy place of Krishna in India called Vrindavan. And he had seen devotees bow down to Krishna. And when he came to the temple in Vrindavan, our temple in Vrindavan, he was surprised to see so many people were not bowing down because of that pride, that false ego, that envy of Krishna. And so he wrote a song, Bow Down, Mister. Like, bow down, Mister. Mister. Oh, Mister. You're like, bow down, Mister. You're not such a big man. Bow down before Krishna. So, but if we can give up that false ego and false pride and false prestige, it's very easy. It's very easy. Because the pure devotee gives you correct instructions on how to live your life. And if you just follow the instructions, you achieve perfection. It's like you go to a doctor, if he's a proper doctor, he diagnoses your disease, and he gives you the proper treatment and the proper diet, and you follow it, and you get cured. It's very easy. But if you're the type, oh, I don't know about that. I know people like to go on the internet, they read up all the different things that people say about the disease, all the different side effects of the medicines, all the different alternatives, and they get like so bewildered. They can't follow any course of treatment and they don't get better. You actually need a doctor and you have to follow the doctor's instructions. Should be a proper doctor, but you can't be your own doctor. You can't be your own guru. In other words, those who heard the morning's talk will realize the connection here. In other words, Lord Sri Krishna is the property of his pure, unconditional devotee. And as such, only the devotees can deliver Krishna to another devotee. Krishna is never obtainable directly. Lord Chaitanya therefore designated himself as Gopi Bartu Padakamalayor
dasa dasa anudasa, are the most obedient servant of the servants of the Lord, who maintains the gopi damsels at Vrindavan. A pure devotee therefore never approaches the Lord directly, but tries to please the servant of the Lord's servants. And thus the Lord becomes pleased. And only then can the devotee relish the taste of the tulsi leaves stuck to the Lord's lotus feet. In the Brahma Samhita, it is said that the Lord is never to be found by becoming a great scholar of the Vedic literatures, but he is very easily approachable through his pure devotee. And now we're coming to another confidential secret, how one can get the Lord's mercy and attain the highest perfection. In Vrindavan, all the pure devotees prayed for the mercy of Srimati Radharani, the pleasure potency of Lord Krishna. She is represented here in the central altar. There's Krishna, and beside him is Radha. And when we chant Hare Krishna, the Hare refers to Radha, and the Krishna refers to Krishna. This is a whole science which we cannot discuss right now, but it's not idol worship. Hare Krishna. So, in Vrindavan, all the pure devotees pray for the mercy of Srimati Radharani, the pleasure potency of Lord Krishna. What does that mean, pleasure potency? What does potency mean? Does anyone know the meaning of the word potency? Yeah, power, energy. So she's the pleasure potency. That means that she's Krishna's energy who has the power to give pleasure to Krishna. And by giving pleasure to Krishna, we experience pleasure. That's where we began earlier. That our pleasure is experienced by giving pleasure to Krishna. So the pleasure that the devotee experiences in devotional service, that is also a manifestation of the pleasure potency of Krishna or Srimati Radharani. Srimati Radharani is a tender-hearted feminine counterpart of the Supreme Whole, resembling the perfectional stage of the worldly feminine nature. In other words, the masculine nature descends from Krishna, but it's reflected in a mundane way here. And the feminine nature descends from Radharani, and that's also reflected in the material world. So, Srimati Radharani is the tender-hearted feminine counterpart of the Supreme Whole. Radha and Krishna together are the Supreme Whole. And she's the feminine, tender-hearted counterpart. And it's usually like that, not always, it's usually like that in families, especially like if someone becomes a devotee and the parents don't like it. Usually the father is a little harder on it, on the child, and the mother is, well, if it makes him happy, if it makes her happy, it's okay. And the father might go, but I wanted you to be this, I wanted you to be that, I had so many hopes and plans for you, and now you become
become a Hare Krishna. But independent of that, Srimati Radharani is a tender-hearted feminine counterpart of the Supreme Whole, resembling the perfectional stage of the worldly feminine nature. Therefore, the mercy of Radharani is available very readily to the sincere devotee. And once she recommends such a devotee to Lord Krishna, the Lord at once accepts the devotee's admittance into his association. The conclusion is, therefore, that one should be more serious about seeking the mercy of the devotee than that of the Lord directly. And by one's doing so, by the goodwill of the devotee, the natural attraction for the service of the Lord will be revived. So by that mercy, our natural attraction for the service of the Lord is revived. And by that attraction, we become eager to serve the Lord. And the Lord ultimately is very kind and merciful also, and he fulfills all of the living entity's desires, and especially when they desire to serve him and experience eternal bliss, he fulfills their desire. So this process of serving the devotee, it begins here with our own, you know, contemporaries, devotees, and it goes all the way up to the spiritual world, all the way to Srimati Radharani, who is the better half of Krishna. So these are actually very deep and confidential topics, but I felt they should be spoken, and I hope that you have understood at least some of the gist of the discussion. So now we'll take a few minutes in case any of you have questions or comments or challenges, and then we'll sing one short prayer, and then there will be vegetarian dinner. So are there any questions or comments? Yes. Do we want to pass around the microphone?
You are explaining about the dead bodies and the moors, etc. So, as you are mentioning that when a person with their attachment, God doesn't want the body, and he gives up the body and he becomes the worst. What if somebody has been killed? Somebody, especially nowadays, we hear a lot of raping things in the media. So somebody wants to enjoy somebody, but they don't want to enjoy it because of the consequences they have been killed. So what will be their destination for those who doesn't want to enjoy the other body or partner and have been killed?
I'm not following. Somebody wants to...
Nowadays we hear someone's raping stories.
Oh, raping.
Yeah. So, in this category, one wants to enjoy, but the other doesn't want to enjoy. Material. So, what... And because of the anger, the guy kills the
other.
So, what will be the destination of that person who's been killed by without their death?
Oh, that's not suicide. That's very different. That's very different. You know, from one point of view, you know, their next birth will depend on their thoughts at the time of death. That's one side, the thoughts at the time of death. The other side is the karma. Now, being murdered like that, although it's very horrible and gruesome and
terrible. But it does free that person of a lot of karma. We don't know what karma the person had, but it does free the person of karma. So it's hard to say, but you know, all other factors being equal, I would say that such a person probably would get a better birth in the next life, because they had some moral principles that, but of course there's so many variables, but they did have some moral principles, and if they did have some bad karma that needed to be exhausted, so definitely being murdered in such a ghastly way would free them. But it's definitely not in the same category as suicide. But the Vedic law is, anyway, there's so many problems in society, and that's why we really need to help people with this knowledge so they don't do these horrible things, the terrible thing to do.
How are the ghosts liberated?
Oh, how are ghosts liberated? That's a very good question. Well, they're liberated by the mercy of devotees. And by hearing the holy name, I mean, the holy name is beneficial to anyone who hears it, no matter what kind of body they're in. Even animals benefit by hearing the holy name. Even plants benefit by hearing the holy name. So ghosts also benefit. And they also benefit by hearing recitation of the Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam. Anything that will bring them in touch with Krishna will serve to free them from the ghostly existence. Yeah. Yes, Gadadhar, and then this. Well, that is a good question. What do we mean by the dust of the lotus feet of the pure devotee? The general explanation would be that it means the instructions of the pure devotee. Taking shelter of a pure devotee means taking shelter of the instructions of the pure devotee. And so taking the dust from the lotus feet of the pure devotee means that condition is fulfilled by following the instructions of the pure devotee. But there's also a literal meaning as well. And there's a verse in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Bhaktapada Duli, Bhaktapada Jal. So Bhaktapada Duli means the dust of the pure devotee. Bhaktapada Jal means the water that has washed the feet of the pure devotee, and the remnants of foodstuffs eaten by the pure devotee. According to Chaitanya Charitamrita 18, these three substances are very powerful, and they can award one love for Krishna. And there's an example in Chaitanya Charitamrita of someone who was very eager to take the dust of the feet of pure devotees, drink the water that washed the feet of pure devotees, and eat the remnants of the foodstuffs of pure devotees. And the explanation is that suppose someone has a highly contagious disease. So, say if that person breathes on you and you inhale those germs, you can get infected. Or if you use the same bathroom that's been infected by the diseased person, you can get the disease. there are so many ways that you can catch a contagious disease from another person. So, in this analogy, the pure devotee is infected with love of Krishna. And by taking that dust, by drinking the water that's washed his or her feet, by eating the remnants of food, just like if someone's sick, their food may be contaminated with their disease, and if you eat what they ate, you can get sick. So it's that's like the negative side. The positive side is someone who has love of Krishna, that love of Krishna, that infection permeates whatever he or she does. And so coming in contact with that person can infect you with that same disease. I'll give two examples from Srila Prabhupada. I was going to begin with the dust of the lotus feet, because that one seems a little harder to experience. But during his last days, I mean, when he was in good health, he didn't really allow his disciples to touch him very much physically. But during his last days, in Vrindavan, he did allow disciples to massage his body. And so, one day I got the opportunity to be at his feet. And there were like little particles of dust. I mean, everything was magnified, because he was a pure devotee and it was Vrindavan. But like each of those little particles was like so vivid. You know, so I thought, well, this is the dust. This is the dust of the lotus feet of the pure devotee. But before then, the very first time when I met Srila Prabhupada in Boston and started to come to the temple, so then Prabhupada left. And I think maybe the day after he left, so the devotees were sitting and eating, honoring prasad. And one disciple came around with some dal, like a split pea soup, that Srila Prabhupada had eaten from. But because it was a couple of days old, I guess they just found it in his apartment after he left. They said it had gone bad. That's what they told me. So they came in the room with this, and they were distributing, like every disciple was just going mad to get that remnants. And I was like new. I'd just been coming for 10 days. And so when they came to my place in the line, they said that, you know, I'm not sure if you want to try this. You know, it's dal, it's been eaten by Srila Prabhupada. But from a material point of view, it's gone bad. But if you have faith, you can try it. I said, okay, I'll try it. So I put that dal in my mouth, and when it touched my tongue, my initial experience was, it's gone off, you know. But then, somehow I reached another level of the experience, and it tasted like the most sublime nectar. I felt like, wow, I've never tasted anything so sublime. So, Bhaktapada Duli, the dust of the feet of the pure devotee, Bhaktapada Jal, the water that's washed the feet, and what's that word? Not utishta, but which is something, remnants of the pure devotee. 18, these three are very powerful substances, and they can award one love of
Krishna.
This is a very good question. She says that someone may begin the course of devotional service but may not be completely successful in the present lifetime. So then what happens to the person? So in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says that the person will begin in the next life where he or she left off in the previous life. So there's no loss or diminution. It's like anything material. Say in this life I've learned 10 different languages. But in my next life, when I'm born, it's I have to start all over again. But spiritually, whatever progress you've made stays with you. Now, it is also said that when one surrenders to the spiritual master, one agrees to follow his instructions to the best of his abilities. But if by chance the disciple is not able to finish the course completely successfully and takes birth again, the spiritual master will come again to deliver that disciple. So how does that work? So again, like in temples every day we sing a song to the spiritual master, Chakudam Dilo Ye Janme Janme, Prabhu says it. He who has given me the gift of transcendental knowledge, he is my Lord, birth after birth. So he will see that you are given a chance to continue from where you left off in the next life. And it may or may not be that he comes personally. He may send someone. And that is also his mercy sometimes. You know, dasa, dasa, anadasa, we might think, oh, I want to be the direct servant of my spiritual master, but it may actually be beneficial to be the servant of your spiritual master. After Srila Prabhupada left, some of Prabhupada's disciples consulted very learned Gaudiya Vaishnava, and they asked him about this point. Because we, you know, Prabhupada had just left. And So his first answer was that he'll make sure that there, Krishna is the original spiritual master. Krishna will make sure that there's someone to guide you so you can make further progress. But the disciples, led by Jamal Krishna Goswami, they were in the mood like, well, we don't want just anyone. We want Prabhupada. So then this elderly Vaishnava said, well, it's really between the spiritual master and Krishna. Because the spiritual master is with Krishna enjoying pastimes in Vrindavan. And then there's these disciples who are still left in the material world who have to be delivered. And so, in this portrayal, Srila Prabhupada would say to Krishna that, I have some disciples in the material world. They want me to come and deliver them. And Krishna said, well, I can send someone, I can arrange someone, you don't have to leave. And he said, well, but they won't accept anyone else. They want only me. And then Krishna said, well, all right, then
you can go. So it's very personal, exactly how it takes place. But it is a fact that once you begin, you will be cared for until the end. But there is no end. It means you'll be cared for eternally. You'll never be without guidance. You'll never be without the opportunity for guidance. And you'll never be without the opportunity for shelter. So she's saying, what if someone begins the process of devotional service and is following the process but never takes initiation? So now, what do you mean that the person is following the process but doesn't take initiation?
Because, for example, tomorrow we're going to have a college and not get initiated. So what would be my destiny?
Well, it really depends on your consciousness. And it depends on how strong your connection with Krishna and his devotees is. But if, in other words, there's a purport in Chaitanya Charitamrita that if something like if one refuses to take initiation from a bona fide spiritual master, then he cannot make progress. In other words, if someone, as we were discussing, you know, bow down mister, if someone out of pride or envy or rebelliousness refuses to accept a spiritual master, well, that's one situation. If someone has a connection, but it has not been formalized by initiation, and the person happens to leave the body, if the connection is strong enough, even without the formality of initiation, one can go to the spiritual master. It's exceptional, but it's certainly possible. Srila Prabhupada, I say disciple, but he was never initiated, but he had one devotee in Bombay, Mr. Sethi. He was an amazing devotee, and he never took initiation. But I shouldn't say that in those terms, because he brought it up to Srila Prabhupada. He said, you know, people are saying, why aren't you initiated? And Srila Prabhupada told him that if you're initiated, you can serve the deity. But you're serving my devotees. And serving the devotees is better than serving the deities. That was part of the answer. And the other part of the answer is that, you know, I need someone like you to do things for me, to get things done in the material world. And if you're initiated, you won't be able to do some of the things that you're doing for me now. So I want you to stay as you are and do the service you're doing. But he was fully, like, sold out to Srila Prabhupada. He had more faith in Srila Prabhupada than you could imagine. And, you know, the account of his, well, his life and then his last days. You know, I think the day he left or the day before he left his body, he was saying, he was telling his family members. I mean, he was, you know, bedridden, completely bedridden. He was telling his family members, you know, pack my bags. I have to go. I said, what are you talking about? Yeah, Prabhupada is here. I have to go pack my bags. Prabhupada's come to get me. So it is possible. He's an extremely staunch, loyal, and dedicated follower of Srila Prabhupada. With personal contact, not like in my mind, oh, Prabhupada's my guru, I never saw him, I never heard him, but it's it. He had real contact with Srila Prabhupada, very deep commitment and relationship with him. And I have no doubt that he's gone to Srila Prabhupada. Well, I think we can end here. I don't think it could get better than this. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.